Welcome to the Commune Podcast. My name is Jeff Krasnow. So a couple of weeks ago, I drove from LA to Phoenix to attend a conference, which is nothing I would recommend doing in an electric vehicle, unless you enjoy frantically looking for functional charging stations in boarded up desert towns. But in any case, on a stretch of empty highway between Blythe and Phoenix, I recorded this episode as I drove, which is also something I might not recommend, but it's neither scripted or edited, minus stripping out a few random barks from my GPS. Now, as you will hear, this episode recounts actually another car ride that I had with my daughter Phoebe last summer, in which I tried to address her question, "Daddy, did the vaccine work?" And I'm sure she is not alone in her confusion. This episode is my attempt to deliver a nuanced answer to that question without the sensationalism and hyperbole that so often accompany this topic. Over the past few years, we have experienced a wicked social polarization, and no issue has divided us more than the vaccine. And I've watched so many people on all sides of the equation attempt to score points on the vaccine issue, essentially sowing fear and distrust, and then riding in on the pony of fear and distrust, often to garner influence. Now, absent from almost all of these wild claims and opinions is nuanced conversation. Now, social media is just truly an awful sandbox for sane public discourse. And this is one of the reasons I'm so fond of podcasts, as it provides a venue to rigorously unpack complicated issues. So, over the next 30 minutes or so, I will say things that you may agree with, and I will likely say things that will challenge your opinions. I'll bumble some sentences and maybe mix up a couple of stats. But this is not about being right. This is about instantiating the kind of thoughtful dialogue that our country and our world so desperately need. In order to tackle the thorniest issues of our time, we need to find the kind of clear thinking that comes from our neomammalian prefrontal cortex. And that's really tricky when everyone seems to be committed to hijacking our amygdalae. So that's my intention here. Okay, without further delay, here's the answer to Phoebe's question. Daddy, did the vaccine work? Okay, so last year I was driving with my daughter Phoebe from Hanalei to Lihue. It's about a 45-minute drive on a good day. And she got in the passenger seat and she said, "Dad, can you explain to me whether or not the vaccine worked or not?" She's like, "Because I'm so confused. Because some people said it worked and some people said it was an abject failure. So what is it?" Of course, she's talking about the COVID vaccine. So I said, "Well, we've got about a 45-minute drive, and that's about how long I would need to answer that question with the nuance that it requires." I was like, "You up for it?" She's like, "I'm up for it. Dad, if you were president, what would you tell me about the vaccine?" So, first of all, I want to try to disentangle the politics of the vaccine from the microbiology, the science of the vaccine, and that's virtually an impossible project given how utterly politicized COVID became. And on a political front, I will just say it was an abject failure in virtually every respect. And I don't think any party has a monopoly on those failings. So first of all, just to clear the air, so people aren't like triggered one way or another, I don't believe in this case that the COVID vaccine should be mandated or should have been mandated. That might change in other circumstances. For example, if the reproduction rate of the virus or the R-naught was more like measles, like 16. Like 16 people get it from each person. And if the mortality rate was 5%, 10%. Now, of course, there would probably not ever need to be a mandate if the virus had been that virulent, or if the virus had had that transmission rate or had been that fatal. We knew fairly quickly that the fatality rate associated with COVID-19 wasn't that high. Now, there is a principle in science called the precautionary principle, and it basically says that when you don't know, you take the greatest amount of precaution. So yeah, in the early months, you know, there were fatality rates posited like 2%, 3%. Well, obviously it turned out to be much, much lower than that. There was also a massive failure to address the underlying health conditions of the American population. And in a way, the monotone policy that eventually came out of the Biden administration with regards to the vaccine, in some ways reflected policy making for the lowest common denominator of health. So again, we knew pretty quickly that the people who contracted COVID most severely suffered from multiple comorbidities like diabetes and obesity. We knew that. But instead of addressing these underlying ground conditions of American health, like, hey, there are all of these panoply of things that you can do to upgrade your health, we came at it with a single solution. Now, to be clear, getting sunlight and getting exercise and eating well doesn't preload you with antibodies. It simply doesn't, but it does provide a layer of defense because it contributes to a balanced immune system. And in some ways, it wasn't that we were looking to bolster our immune systems. It's that Americans already had overly agitated immune systems. And this is what we saw with the cytokine storms that were responsible for many of the fatalities associated with COVID. It was an overstimulation or an overreaction. So we never really addressed any of those underlying conditions, and it was just a massive missed opportunity for Americans to really, really take a better look at their health. I mean, we incentivized the vaccine, you know, with McDonald's in some cases. So then there's that. And the Biden administration certainly didn't help itself by using rhetoric like this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That didn't do any good because trust was already eroding in our institutions. And to come down hard with, again, with a single monotone solution only fostered greater resentment and potential distrust. There was nobody in the administration that was updating people on the shifting ground conditions of the virus itself. And in a way, there's an old Taoist saying, when you don't trust the people, you make them untrustworthy. And in many ways, that is what happened. Now, there were times across the course of the pandemic when I felt that people should have made their own choice to get vaccinated. And really, that was mostly around Delta. I think that was like August 2021, where we knew that there was a mutation of the virus that had a very high transmission rate, seemed to have a very high viral load, and was potentially more fatal than previous iterations. So if people were going to go out and be in public and be around a lot of people and potentially asymptomatically spread the virus, that was a point in time where I thought, yeah, people should make the conscious choice to get vaccinated. We live within a social contract. You know, we give up certain rights to get other greater rights, and that we're all in this together. I mean, there is no better example of the nature of our interconnected fate than a virus or a viral pandemic. That being said, I still don't think it should have been mandated. And it was only mandated in certain realms, like in the military, for example, and private companies developed their own policies around that. And I think that that's probably good, that private companies are free to develop their own policies around the safety of their employees. Okay, now let's pivot over to the science for a minute, because I think the more that people can understand the nature of virology and of vaccinology, the less politicized in a way this would be. And this, again, was a great misstep and oversight by both administrations. I mean, we should have just had daily briefings about basic science. This was, again, an opportunity for Americans to learn, and many did. Many took it upon themselves to autodidactically learn about vaccinology and the immune system. So in January 2020, when the virus really reared its ugly head and we became more aware of it, biologists very quickly mapped the genome of the virus and identified this particular spike protein. So a virus needs a packet in which to live. It can't operate on its own like a bacteria. So it needs like a protein and fat to move it around. So we all quickly learned about this spike protein. The spike protein was the responsible agent for essentially creating the envelope by which the virus would pass into a healthy cell. So if you remember, people might sneeze, the virus would be in these water droplets that might enter your mouth or your nose or some other mucosal layer, and that might connect with some form of cell in your upper respiratory, and this spike protein would connect to a specific receptor on the cell called an ACE2 receptor and bind to it, and then essentially create the envelope through which the virus would enter the cell and hijack the reproductive capabilities of said cell and make more virus and lead to greater infection. So that's how this particular virus was transmitted. Okay, so we mapped the genome of this particular virus, and we knew the code for making the spike protein, okay? So RNA is basically like the code, the transcription, the recipe for creating proteins. So typically, vaccines in the old school have been attenuated viruses or dead viruses that with the right dose get injected and stimulate an immune response, right? So really what vaccines do is they leverage the body's own innate wisdom, or I should say adaptive wisdom in this particular case, through low-grade exposure to a pathogen, a bacteria, or a virus, such that then the immune system recognizes that pathogen as an invader, as something foreign, and then begins to produce certain proteins that we know as antibodies to essentially neuter that virus, that antigen. And there's this process of phagocytosis, kind of amazing, where the antibody kind of literally eats the antigen and kind of metabolizes it. And the amazing thing about it is that these T cells and B cells, that part of the adaptive immune system, these leukocytes have memory. And the amazing thing is that these adaptive immune cells, these leukocytes like B cells and T cells, have memory. So essentially, if you get a vaccine and your body then develops these antibodies, your body will then remember the recipe for those antibodies. They will remember the pathogen such that if you come into contact naturally with that pathogen, you are preloaded with those antibodies. So that's how the old school vaccines work. But they always took a lot of time because getting the exact right dosage of the attenuated or dead virus took a lot of trials. And in this particular case, we felt tremendous time pressure to move quicker. Now, that said, some of the vaccines that were developed in China and in Russia, I believe, did use that old technology. But of course, the ones that we're most familiar with in the West, and certainly in the United States, were the mRNA vaccines that were products of Moderna and Pfizer. So the mRNA technology had actually been around since the 90s, but it had never been used in a vaccine. So what is mRNA? Well, we kind of know what DNA is, right? So DNA lives inside the nucleus of the cell and contains sort of the blueprints, right? The recipes, the amino acid sequences of proteins. And so it sends the RNA out into the cytoplasm of the cell such that the ribosomes can use those recipes to create proteins and other byproducts. So this is really what was happening with this vaccine. We were essentially creating the recipe for that spike protein, for that binding agent. So when you got the Pfizer or the Moderna injection, that's what you were getting. You were getting the recipe for your cells to make the spike protein. Now, the recipe for the spike protein from the vaccine was a little bit different than the natural occurring spike protein associated with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It didn't have the same binding capability, but still it resembled the spike protein in enough respect that the body would recognize it as foreign, right? And then make the antibodies such that when you contract, such that when you came into contact with the COVID virus and its spike protein naturally, you were preloaded with those antibodies. Okay, so the actual development of that mRNA vaccine was very, very quick because we can map genetics so quickly right now. So they actually developed the vaccine, you know, I don't know, within like months or within weeks maybe. But then of course you have to test it. So Pfizer and Moderna actually did do very thorough, what you might call gold standard clinical trials, double blind randomized trials. And it got into human trials in the third phase trials in like October of 2020. Now reflect for a moment how quickly that happened given that, you know, lockdown happened in March 2020. So in the Pfizer trial, if I remember correctly, there were like 44,000 people, 22,000 people who got the vaccine, 22,000 people in the placebo group. And I think Moderna had less, I think maybe like 20,000, 10,000 in the control group and 10,000 people getting the vaccine. So that happened, and there was enough virus out there in the environment that they waited for 100 people to actually contract the virus or contract the disease. And then they pulled back the curtain, and of those 100 people, 5 people had gotten the vaccine and 95 people had gotten the placebo or no vaccine. So from that data, they determined that the efficacy rate was 95%. So that set up a certain expectation that the vaccine protected from transmission. And that concept, that transmission protection, was certainly echoed by all of our public health agencies and by both administrations, really, but primarily the Biden administration, because he took office in January 21, right when the vaccine was really becoming available. What a crazy time. Anyhow, the vaccine then rolled out and people started to get it. And initially, it did seem like it provided a good amount of protection from transmission, right? It also seemed to provide a lot of protection from severe contraction of the disease in terms of hospitalizations and fatalities. But what was happening with this virus all this time? Well, of course, there was the initial iteration of it, the ancestral strain that had a particular genomics, and that genomics was then reflected in the spike protein. Of course, from a virus's view of the universe, it just wants to survive, and it will evolve and mutate in order to do so. So there will be different random mutations, and some of those mutations will be adaptive and produce renditions that are more likely to survive and thrive, and ironically produce mutations that are not quite as fatal in many cases, because a virus doesn't want to have a super high fatality rate, because then it kills its host before the host can spread the virus, right? So all this time, as the vaccine was being developed, and then it was going through trials, and then it was going through a rollout process, the virus was mutating billions upon billions upon billions of times, right? Now, we heard about Delta and Omicron and a couple of other versions of it, right? But those are the ones just we heard of because they rose to the top as the more successful mutations. You know, viruses are mutating all the time, billions upon billions of times. So by the time Delta came around, and then certainly by the time Omicron came around, the vaccine was old hat. And by that, I mean it was engineered for the ancestral strain. But now the spike protein looked very different. So it wasn't like the vaccine was evolving with the virus. The vaccine, the formula just stayed the same. So it became less and less effective over time at protecting from transmission. And just to kind of hop over to the political realm for a second, as breakthrough cases became more and more common, and I had COVID 3 times, the confidence in the vaccine and the confidence in the public health agencies and the communication coming from the administration started to waver and eventually erode. But it is very important to understand that the reason that the vaccine became less and less effective was because it was engineered for a virus that then had subsequently mutated billions of times, okay? And this is just to say that the science and the microbiology and the vaccinology and the people wearing the white coats, all in all, did a pretty amazing job. It was really politics that failed us. And of course, because we live in this uber polarized time, the politics of the vaccine took on a certain dimension, such that if you were liberal or democratic, you know, you had this sort of monotone, everyone should get the vaccine mentality. And if you were on the right or more libertarian, you felt that government should get out of your life and that COVID was kind of just a little bit worse than the flu. However, even though over time the vaccine became less effective at protecting against transmission, it did seem to largely hold up in terms of protecting people from severe contraction and from death. Now, there's a number of studies. I think the Commonwealth Fund published a study that estimates through statistical analysis that the vaccine saved approximately 3 million lives. Now, of course, you can question that all day. I think that study was conducted by a bunch of doctors from Yale. But of course, we don't really trust our elite institutions anymore. And that whole word elite has taken on a very, very strange tenor. Because of course, we want things to be elite. Like, we want our Navy SEALs to be elite when they're on a special mission. But somehow that word has become tainted, and there again is a lot of distrust in institutions that are considered elite, like Yale. That being said, I think the vaccine probably did save a lot of people's lives and probably a good amount of money in terms of hospitalization and other things. Now, there are a lot of people that died who might not have died had they gotten the vaccine. And I've seen statistical analyses that suggest that that number is around 300,000. So the skepticism that was created because of politics, largely, that inhibited people from getting the vaccine seem to have very, very deadly consequences. Now, of course, we could argue with that study too. Candidly, I just don't know, but all the data that I have seen certainly suggests that the vaccine was effective at minimizing death and severe contraction and hospitalization. Now, did the vaccine cause adverse reactions and injury? Yeah, I think it did. In some cases, certainly there was a higher prevalence of myocarditis, particularly among teenage boys. And, you know, that finding came out of the data on VAERS, the online governmental platform for the reporting of adverse reactions. There are certainly some other trends around tinnitus, around women and their menstrual cycle that seemed quite concerning. And I don't understand why we couldn't have taken those reports seriously and not essentially dismissed them in the mainstream media and then balanced them against the whole purpose of vaccines in the first place, which is based around utilitarianism, where there is a risk benefit analysis that you have to do, and that we need to make decisions that benefit the many, right? sometimes at the expense of the few. And this is where vaccines are so tough, because it is really at the core kind of an argument of utilitarianism against humanitarianism. And I think if we could have just had that public discourse, honestly, then people would have gotten more behind it. And we would have been less polarized, and we would have been able just to see the whole thing with clearer eyes and not through the political invective. So this is more or less the diatribe that I gave Phoebe in the car. And ironically, I'm in the car again, driving from LA to Phoenix, which was not a particularly intelligent decision, but it did yield this oratory. And I think the moral here is that we really just have to have better public discourse. We have to believe in the marketplace of ideas. We have to trust people and their ability to understand complicated concepts and nuance. And again, when you don't trust the people, you make them untrustworthy. And unfortunately, that's what we're living in. We're living through this epic distrust of our institutions, of journalism and media, of science, of government. And this is the exact moment in history when we really need those institutions to function at their best and hold them to account and to be better. But in many cases, we seem dead set on burning them down. And that worries me, because to date, I have not found a system better than liberal democracy, with all of its warts, to organize society. And liberal democracy relies on these institutions really to function well. So we need to build trust back into them. And the way that we do that is through honest, open conversation. So if this ever happens again, this is the kind of conversation, the one that I just had, is the one, if I were president, that I would have every day with the American people and say, today is slightly different than yesterday, because this mutation happened, or this trial finished, and here's where we are, and this is what we have to do to come together as a country. And no, we're not going to mandate it, but we are going to educate you and then trust you to make the best decisions for you, for your family, and for your community, and really merge this notion that our individual freedoms and our collective freedoms are really one and the same. So I want to do everything I can to foster this kind of middle ground wherever it's possible. Okay, thanks a lot for listening and reviewing this episode. I noticed that there were a number of topics that I failed to address, but that's okay. I can't remember everything on the spot. So hopefully I will address those in future episodes. Regardless, if you're interested in engaging on this topic respectfully and thoughtfully, then I'm here, available at jeffk@onecommune.com. Okay, that's all from the commune for today. My name is Jeff Krasno, and I am here for you.